heading for the gym. Great. Dante went down to the basement level. One of the appeals of the house had been the elaborate underground rooms. Not many California homes had basements. Digging 25 feet down was a nightmare of rocks, large and small, sandstone boulders sunk in heavy clay soil that cost a fortune to remove. This house had been built in 1927 by a guy who made his money in the stock market and held on to it through the crash. The house was solid and gave Dante a sense of safety and permanence. He came up the stairs and into the pool house. He knew Lola was on the treadmill because the sound on the TV had been jacked up to account for the grinding noise of the moving platform and the thumping of athletic shoes. He paused in the corridor, watching her through the half-open door. It had been a mistake, confiding in Talia. He might have gone his whole life without opening himself up to her candor and her acid tongue. He'd done it because he knew she'd play straight and shoot from the hip. He thought he'd blocked Talia's comments, but she'd changed his perception in 25 words or less. He could already feel the difference, how Lola had looked this morning, sprawled across the bed in sleep, and how she looked now. She wore makeup when she worked out, even knowing she was alone. She still had the same dark eyes, lined with charcoal and looking enormous in her narrow face. She still had the mane of dark hair. It was straggly at the moment because she was sweating heavily. But he didn't mind that. What he saw, thanks to Talia's remarks, was how tiny she'd become. Her shoulders were narrow. Her head incongruously balanced on a neck as thin as a pipe. She looked like one of those elongated creatures who steps out of a spacecraft, moving languidly through mist and smoke. Oddly familiar, and at the same time, not of this world. When she caught sight of him, she muted the sound but continued to run. She was wearing sweatpants and an oversized long-sleeve T-shirt, with the cuffs turned back to expose wrists that were all bone. Fingers strung together with tendons that lay along the tops of her hands like piano wire. He said, "Hey, come on, pack it in for tonight. You look pooped." She checked the readout on the machine. 5 more minutes, and then I'll quit. She popped the mute button again, and the sound blared as she ran on. While he waited, he puttered around the place. The room was 20 feet by 20, lined with mirrors and fitted out with weightlifting equipment, 2 treadmills, a recumbent bike, and an upright stationary bike. How many hours a day did she spend in here? When her time was up, the machine put her through a 5-minute cooldown, and then she finally shut it off. He handed her a towel, which she pressed against her face. When she blotted the sweat that trickled down her neck, a peachy beige foundation came off on the towel. He put an arm across her shoulders and walked her to the door, shutting off light switches as they passed. Lola put an arm around his waist. "So? What did Talia say?"
"About what?"
"Come on, Dante, you know what." "She wasn't thrilled." "Of course not. She thinks I'm neurotic, temperamental, and self-centered. I'm sure she thinks I'd suck as a wife and suck even worse as a mom." "She didn't say that." "But you stop trying to protect me. I'm a big girl, so spell it out. I want to know what she said." Dante sorted through Talia's objections and picked one.
"She wondered about the weight gain. She thought a pregnancy would be hard on you."
"And?"
"She might have a point.
I worry about you." "I know you do. And you're a sweet guy. You can tell her the baby's a non-issue. I haven't had a period for a year. She'll be tickled to death."
"Let's not talk about that now. We have time once you get healthy again."
"Ha!
You know there's help out there if you're interested."
She leaned her head against his shoulder, matching her step to his. "That's what I love about you. You never give up hope. You think if you keep at it long enough, everything will turn out all right."
"You don't see it that way."
"Here's my view. I think this relationship has run its course. I'm releasing you from any sense of obligation because that's the only thing keeping you here.
The rest has been gone for a long time. Dante squeezed her shoulder, but he made no reply. There was a time when the remark would have cut him to the core. Now his thoughts reverted to Nora with a flicker of joy. He drove Cappy to the Allied Distributors warehouse in Colgate, to the shipping and receiving department. Pop had acquired the brick-and-frame complex in the days when he was running booze. Dante had adapted the structure for his purposes, expanding the square footage by incorporating a prefab steel addition across the front. The mechanicals were below ground, a largely unfinished area that Pop had always referred to as the catacombs. Dante suspected there were actually more than a few bodies buried there. He'd take a flashlight down and explore the space from time to time, occasionally coming across dusty cases of whiskey and gin tucked away in the odd corner. As the two walked from the parking lot to the loading dock, Dante filled him in on the basics. Audrey was a trotter, the middleman between the whips and the baggers. She covered the tri-counties, coordinating the Central Coast operation with San Francisco and points north. Ordinarily, she wouldn't have been on the scene, but one of our pickers was arrested on a bad check charge and she was filling in. You tossed her off the bridge and the entire circuit was thrown into disarray. We're still scrambling for coverage. How was I supposed to know? Cut the whining. I'm done hassling you on that score. You fucked up, big time. You should have asked, but we'll leave it at that. I'm trying to get you to understand how the system works. That's what you're so hot to hear about, right? Well, yeah. If you want me to be useful. All right. So the trotters pay the pickers for a day's work. Usually runs about $3,000 in cash. The goods are called the crop, or the bale, sometimes the bag. Workers we call crop dusters, strip tags and remove identifying marks. They meet every couple of weeks. Where? A couple of places we rent. There's a regular route we call the tour. The guys who drive it we call cabbies. Don't worry about job titles. I know it's a lot to take in. It's a tight fit. Take out any one of the players and you got a problem on your hands. How many people are we talking about? Enough. We make sure each crew knows as little as possible about the other crews, so if there's a breakdown, no one's in a position to expose the rest. Eventually, the crop comes off the circuit and lands here for distribution. To where? That depends. San Pedro, Corpus Christi, Miami. At every point along the way, the crop's passing through hands of people I know I can trust. Doesn't always work that way here. This is the current trouble spot. We've been hit twice. Last week, someone walked off with a pallet of pharmaceuticals. Now we're short cartons of infant formula. I can't even get a count on that. I thought it was a clerical error. Someone puts a decimal in the wrong place and it throws everything off. This is not a paper loss. Somebody stealing from us? You gotta be kidding. We don't recruit help from vacation Bible schools. Point is, we have to limit access to the loading docks. This is the area where we're most vulnerable. Guys come out for a smoke and end up hanging around. It doesn't look like they're doing much, but they've got no business being here. We're initiating new oversight procedures, which is where you come in. Cappy's tone of voice took on an edge. And you want me to do what? Stand here with a clipboard, counting widgets and making sure everybody has a hall pass? If you want to look at it like that, yes. Once a shipment's inside the building, someone has to reconcile the goods with the manifest. What's with the lingo? What the fuck is a manifest? A list of goods. Same as an invoice. An itemized account of what's been shipped to us and where it goes next. In the meantime, we hold everything here until it's ready to be moved. Why didn't you say so in the first place? I can't learn anything with you lecturing me. You yap, 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 and what goes in one ear goes out the other. I can't retain it if I don't see it written down. Like I learn with my eyes. I need facts and figures so I can understand how all the pieces fit. You know what I'm saying? The pipeline, accounts payable, and stuff like that. I have bookkeepers for that end of the business. I need you here. Yeah, but you haven't really said where these shipments are coming from or where they go. I know it's Allied distributors, but I don't have a clue what we distribute. Baby food? That don't make sense. Doesn't have to make sense to you. It makes sense to me. But where are all the records kept? Has to be written down someplace. You don't carry this stuff in your head. Something happens to you, then what? Why the sudden curiosity? Years we've been doing this, and you never gave a shit. Fuck you. Pop said it was time I learned. I'm here doing the best I can, and you criticize me for not showing interest before. It's a legitimate question. Sorry if I seem skeptical, but what do you expect? What kind of shit is that? You either trust me or you don't. I don't. You accusing me of something? Why so defensive? I'm not defensive. All I'm asking is how you run an operation this size without somebody writes it down. Dante dropped his gaze, working to control his temper. If Cappy was pressing for the information, he'd get information. Dante said, okay, fuck it. I'll tell you how. You see that computer terminal over there? To the right, just inside the door that led into the warehouse proper, there was an unmanned desk with a computer keyboard and monitor, the CPU tucked into the knee-hole space. Dante could see Cappy's gaze shift to the darkened computer screen. What? That thing? That thing, as you refer to it, is a remote terminal with access from the house and the office downtown. In the wall behind, there are dedicated lines laid in. It may not look like much, but that's the brains of the business. It's how we keep track. We got backup on backup. Password changes from week to week, and the hard drive is purged every Thursday at noon. Clean slate. The only dollar figures left look legitimate. You wipe out everything? How can you do that? To all appearances, yes. If files are subpoenaed, they got nothing on us. I thought files stayed in the machine even when it looks like it's erased. Since when do you know shit about computers? Hey, I hear stuff like everybody else. I thought the FBI had experts. So do we. What if there's a goof? Like what? I don't know. Power outage, something like that. Computer freezes up before a purge is complete. Then we're screwed. Any other questions? Cappy said, I'm cool. Good. Now maybe we can move on to the problem at hand. This is the hole needs patching. I'd like to know who's bleeding us, but more important, I want to put a stop to it. Why me? What if I don't want to stand out here in a coverall like some stupid-ass warehouse goon? Dante smiled, wishing he could punch his brother's lights out. You have an attitude problem, you know that? This is chicken shit. Pop said bring me in. What you're doing here is keeping me out. This is in. Where you're standing right now. You want more? You can earn it, like I did. He left Cappy on the loading dock while he went up the metal stairs to the mezzanine level, where operations were housed in five offices behind a wall of waist-high windows. From there, he could see much of the warehouse operation. Guys on forklifts, speeding along the narrow corridors between two-story-high storage bays. Guys engaged in private conversations, unaware that he was watching. His office here was crude, the basics, no refinement whatever. Dante didn't have a view of the loading dock, but he'd mounted security cameras in strategic locations. Cappy was trouble. He'd been out of prison for 6 months, his release dependent on his having a job. Previously, he'd worked construction as a heavy equipment operator, making good money until he was fired for drinking on the job. His response had been to climb back on the bulldozer and plow into the construction trailer, destroying the trailer and all its contents, and narrowly missing the job site supervisor, who was injured by flying debris. Along with a laundry list of property crimes, he'd been charged with aggravated assault, assault with a deadly weapon, and attempted murder, which was how he'd ended up in Soledad. Pop wanted him brought into the business, so Dante had put him on the payroll. Cappy reported this to his parole officer without mentioning he'd never shown up for work. He told Pop he needed time to get reacquainted with his wife and kids. What kept him busy was honing his pool skills in the family room of his house in Colgate. In public, he was careful to avoid bars, firearms, and the company of known criminals. At home, he went through 2 6-packs of beer a day and popped his wife in the face if she complained. After a month of this, Dante had finally insisted that Cappy show up for work, a move he now regretted. In the absence of an intercom, Dante hollered for his secretary in the outer office.
Bernice, could you come in here, please?
In a minute. I got stuff to finish first. Dante shook his head. The girl was 19. He'd hired her 4 months before, and she already had his number. He sorted through the papers on his desk until Bernice appeared in the door. She was tall and lanky, with a big wad of frizzy blonde hair she wore in a ponytail. She came to work in jeans and running shoes, which was fine with him. The low-cut top he could have done without. Weren't women these days taught anything about modesty?
What?
She said.
You know my brother? I look like an idiot. Everybody knows Cappy. He's crazy as a loon.
I'd like you to keep an eye on him. He's new to the concept of work for pay. I don't think he's got the hang of it yet.
I charge extra to babysit, she said.
How about spying? The idea seemed more appealing to her.
You want regular reports?
That would be nice, he said. Meanwhile, get Dade O'Hagan on the line. His number's in there. He pushed the Rolodex in her direction and watched as she worked her way through.
O'Hagan, like the mayor?
Ex-mayor. You're behind the times. This is old business. I'm calling in a marker if it's any of your concern. She smiled.
Hot stuff.
You bet. Chapter 15. I left Marvin's house at 2:15 with a promise to keep him posted on my progress. I was feeling more optimistic. Marvin's mention of time travel had sparked a train of thought. I, too, had regretted I couldn't go back to relive those moments in the parking garage when I'd blown the opportunity to pick up the plate number on the black sedan. The nice man who'd come to my aid had suggested I notify mall security and file a report. At the time, I'd been distracted by my outrage, my throbbing shin, and my badly scraped palm. With Marvin's offhand remark, it dawned on me that I did have a way to go back in time and review events. I knew the woman in charge of mall security. Maria Gutierrez had been the beat officer assigned to my neighborhood some 6 years before. On the last case I'd worked, I had crossed paths with her former partner, Gerald Pettigrew, who was now in charge of the canine unit at the Santa Teresa Police Department. Maria's name hadn't come up in conversation, but she'd been on my mind. Some months before, I'd found myself standing behind her in the checkout line at the supermarket. She looked familiar, but she wasn't in uniform, and I didn't make the connection. She'd been quicker at the recognition. She greeted me by name and identified herself. As we inched our way closer to the register, we played a quick game of catch-up. I filled her in on my life, Henry's whereabouts, and my last encounter with Lieutenant Dolan, whom she knew from the police department. She told me she'd resigned from the PD in order to take a job in the private sector. That's when she'd given me her business card. I stopped by my office and sorted through the pile of business cards I routinely toss in my bottom drawer. After a bit of digging, I found hers. And I was just about to call when I noticed the light blinking on my answering machine. I punched play.
Hello, Kinsey. This is Diana Alvarez. Please don't hang up. I need to talk to you about the article I'm writing. I'm offering you the opportunity to clarify the facts and add any comments you might have. Otherwise, it's going in as is. My number is...
I didn't bother to make a note. I checked the phone number on Maria's business card and called her instead. I told her what had occurred and asked if I could have a look at security tapes for April 22nd. I thought she might be wary. Security measures are considered proprietary and therefore not to be disseminated to the general public. Information leaks are more likely to serve the criminal element than the law-abiding citizen. So it's better for all of us if crooks are kept in the dark about how the traps are set. Apparently, the fact that I was a PI and already known to her constituted a waiver. I gave her my guarantee that the information would remain confidential. She said she had a meeting at 3, but if I could make it to her office before then, she'd be happy to help. 2 minutes later, I was in my car and on my way. Screw Diana Alvarez. I found a parking spot at the Nordstrom's end of the underground structure at Passages Shopping Plaza. I bypassed the escalator and took the stairs up a level where the retail storefronts had been designed to resemble an old Spanish town. The narrow shoulder-to-shoulder buildings varied in height. Most were stucco with the occasional picturesque chunk of plaster missing to expose the faux brick underneath. Some boasted pricey second and third floor offices with shutters at the windows and flower boxes on the sills. Along the wide central plaza corridor, there were boutique restaurants with outdoor tables, benches for weary shoppers, and kiosks selling sunglasses, junk jewelry, and women's hairpieces. At the midpoint, a stage had been constructed where musicians played for summer tourists. I went up a wide set of red-tiled stairs to the second floor. To my right, there was an auditorium available to local theater groups for stage productions. The mall business offices were located down a hall to the left. Maria was waiting at the desk when I walked in. "You're a doll to do this," I said. "No problem. The police circulated the information to all the store managers and CC'd us so we'd know what was going on. Included with the bulletin was Audrey Vance's mugshot." "Did you recognize her?" "Not me, but I heard a sales girl at Victoria's Secret saw her the same day. Apparently, she's a regular customer and nobody had any idea she was stealing from them. They're doing an inventory check now to see how badly they were hit." "I thought these gangs originated in South America." "Oh, those are the worst. They can sweep through and clear a tabletop in a blink of an eye. They blast into town, and they're gone again just that quick." "How does it work? They have to be highly organized, but I don't understand how they operate." "You start with the worker bees, who go out and steal the merchandise. Sometimes they're given a regular shopping list, products the fence knows he can sell. For instance, there's a big traffic in Gillette razor blades, Tylenol, Excedrin, pregnancy tests, diabetic test strips. I've heard oil of Olay products are a hot ticket as well. The list goes on and changes all the time." "You mentioned Victoria's Secret." "Sure. Think of how many bras you can fit in a shopping bag. Same with pantyhose. It's much tougher to steal bulky items like men's cologne sets or VCRs. You can't jam a TV down the front of your pants." "But where does the fence lay off the goods?" "Swap meets are a good bet. Thrift stores, places like that. A lot is shipped out of the country." "Are these rings run by the mob?" "Not in the old-fashioned sense of the word. If the business was mob-run, you'd have a widespread network that might be vulnerable to infiltration. These crews are connected loosely, if they're connected at all, which makes apprehension and prosecution a pain in the butt. In each city, the setup is different, depending on how many people have been brought in and what kind of fencing operation is up and running in any given area." "I remember the good old days when I was a rookie. Shoplifters were amateurs." "Not anymore. We still have the dabblers and the wannabes, teenagers sneaking record albums into their backpacks, thinking they can get away with it. Kids are the least of our worries. Though if you ask me, we ought to go after them and nail them." She waved a hand, impatient with the subject. "Don't get me started. Come on back and let's take a look at what we've got." "You still like the new job?" "I love it," she said over her shoulder. I followed her down a short hall to an office outfitted with closed-circuit television cameras, massed together in an alcove. There were 10 monitors mounted in proximity, all working independently. A young man in civilian clothes sat in a swivel chair, remote control in hand, Following the live images as they flipped from view to view, the two of us stood and watched. Depending on the angle, I could just about guess where each camera was mounted, though, in truth, I'd never noticed them before. Both entrances and both exits of the parking garage were covered. There were an additional 6 cameras anchored at the second floor level, each one focused on a different line of sight. I followed one shopper from the time she entered the mall off State Street until she turned left into the main avenue and disappeared from sight. Another camera picked her up as she proceeded down the wide walk toward Macy's and went into the store. None of the pedestrians seemed to have any idea they were being watched. "These work off coaxial cables," Maria said. "All of the cameras operate at the same time. By swapping out cassettes, we can capture images 24 hours a day over the course of a month. Unless we have reason to keep a cassette, we tape over what we've done. Eventually, the tapes get worn or the CCTV heads get dirty, and the images end up fuzzy and not much use. After I talked to you, I pulled the cassette from last Friday." She turned to her desk and picked up 4 cassettes. "There's a VCR next door." We went into the next office, which was plainly furnished and looked like it was called into service on occasions when a mall executive was in town and needed temporary space. She pulled up a straight chair for me while she took the swivel chair behind the desk and rolled it closer to the set. The VCR was wired to a small black-and-white television that looked like something right out of the 1960s. The screen small and the housing enormous. She checked the date on the first cassette and slid it into the machine. "You said between 5:30 and 6:15. "Roughly. It was 5:26 when I looked at my watch. That's when I first saw Audrey slide the PJs into her bag." She was the older of 2 women working the lingerie department. By the time the loss prevention officer was called and the whole scene played out, I'd say it was closer to 5:45, I said. "I could be off. Time gets distorted when you're caught up in these things. At the time, everything went by in a blur, and that's why I missed the plate number. I was so astonished at what happened, I didn't register much else." "I know the feeling. On the one hand, you're hyper-aware, and at the same time, you blank out the details." "Amen." I couldn't for the life of me go back and reconstruct the incident. "Don't I know," she said. "A foot chase you swear took 15 minutes turns out to be half that. Sometimes it works the other way." With a remote, she fast-forwarded. Date and timestamp sailed along in the upper right-hand corner. It was like watching an old-time movie, people walking herky-jerky, cars zooming by so quickly they seemed to leave a trail of after-images. I was amazed at how much the eye could pick up from that fleeting series of pictures. When she reached April 22nd, she slowed the stream of images to a more stately pace. I pointed and said, "There." Maria hit the pause button and rewound the tape. The black Mercedes sedan, which was halfway up the ramp, reversed itself and disappeared from sight. She advanced the film by degrees. The car reappeared, and I saw the younger woman hand a ticket to the parking attendant, who ran it into her machine. The attendant verified the timestamp, put the ticket to one side, and waved her on. The younger woman looked left and smiled, smug and self-satisfied. That much I remembered. As the sedan continued up the ramp, Maria paused the tape again, freezing the shot of the rear bumper. The license frame was in view, but the plate had been removed. "Now you know why you missed it," she said. "What shitty luck. I thought if I picked up the plate number, someone at the PD might run it for me." Maria said, "Let's look at it again." She caught the Mercedes on its way up the ramp. It came to a halt with a flick of her remote and disappeared from sight, reversing down the ramp. We watched it as though it were the slow-motion photo finish of a horse race. "Check the license plate frame," she said. "Top says, keep honking. Bottom says, I'm reloading." She squinted and tilted her head. "What's that on the right side of the bumper?" As the car came up the ramp, she stopped the picture mid-frame. There was a bumper sticker affixed to the right-hand side. I got up and peered more closely, but the picture seemed to dissolve. Both Maria and I backed up halfway across the width of the office space. She smiled. That should help. Can you read that? I asked. Sure. You ought to get your eyes checked. Says, my daughter is on the honor roll at Klimping Academy.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Right. All you have to do now is find the car. I've tackled tougher jobs in my day.
I'll bet.
Keep me posted. I want to hear how this turns out. Running surveillance is an exercise in ingenuity. As a rule, sitting in a parked car for an extended period generates public uneasiness, especially in a school zone where parents are fretful about abductions, kidnap for ransom, and other forms of child-oriented mischief. Horton Ravine is a natural habitat for wealthy people with expensive tastes. There might be 100 black Mercedes sedans passing back and forth to the front and rear gates. With roughly 800 private homes spread over 1,800 acres, my only hope of spotting the car was to find an observation post and wait. After a quick drive through the area, I decided the obvious location was at the foot of the private drive leading up the hill to Klimping Academy. I had to take into consideration that the woman's bumper sticker might be out of date. Her daughter might have already graduated from Klimping. She might have dropped out or transferred to another school. Even if she were currently enrolled, her dad might be in charge of drop-off and pick-up, using another vehicle altogether. Meanwhile, I had to come up with a reasonable explanation for my presence on the road where I intended to keep watch. For short stints, the appearance of car trouble will sometimes work. With the hood up, a puzzled look on my face, and my owner's manual in hand, I can stall for an hour unless a good Samaritan comes to my aid. This happens with annoying frequency when I'm least desirous of the help. Devious creature that I am, an idea occurred to me almost instantly. I left Horton Ravine and took the 101 to a strip mall in Colgate, where I'd seen a large Kraft Mart two doors down from an office supply store. In the latter, I bought a handheld tally counter, a device that advances one number with each click of a button. At the craft shop, I bought two pieces of heavy-duty poster board, 36 inches square, and 10 packets of self-adhesive black alphabet letters, with a bonus pack of most often used vowels and consonants. I went home with my packages and set to work on my kitchen counter. With the poster board and stick-on alphabet, I fashioned a sandwich board sign, hinged at the top with the same message visible on both the front flap and the back. When I finished the job, I leaned the sign against the wall and climbed the spiral stairs. I sorted through the hanging clothes in my closet and took out my generic uniform, an outfit I'd designed myself and had made many years before. The pants and matching shirt were constructed of a sturdy, no-nonsense dark blue twill, complete with brass buttons, epaulettes, and belt loops through which I can thread a wide black leather belt. On each sleeve, I'd sewn a round patch with Santa Teresa services embroidered in gold. In the center of the patch, there was a vaguely governmental emblem. If I wore clunky black lace-up Oxfords and carried a clipboard, I could easily pass for a city or county employee. I hung the uniform on a peg, ready for my next day's work. It was almost 5 by then, time, I thought, to check in with Henry back in Michigan. I hadn't talked to him since Monday, and I felt a twinge of guilt that poor Nell and her broken hip hadn't even crossed my mind. I sat down at my desk and punched in the Michigan number, mentally composing a summary of what had transpired over the past couple of days. The number rang 5 times, and just when I thought the machine would kick in, Henry's brother Charlie picked up.
Pitts, this is Charlie. You'll have to speak up. I'm deaf as a post.
I raised my voice. Charlie, this is Kinsey. Out in California.
Who?
Kinsey, Henry's California neighbor. Is he there?
Who?
Henry.
Oh, hang on.
I could hear muffled conversation, and then Henry took the handset, saying, "This is Henry." Once we sorted out who was who, Henry brought me up to speed on Nell's condition. "She's fine. She's tough as nails, and never a word of complaint." He said she'd be in a residential rehab facility for another 10 days. They'd come up with a pain management plan to help her tolerate the physical therapy sessions twice a day. Meanwhile, Henry, Charlie, and Lewis spent the better part of the day with her, playing board games to keep her mind off her infirmity. As soon as she mastered her walker, she'd be allowed to come home. "How's your shin?" he asked. I pulled up the leg of my jeans and had a look, as though he could see it as well. More blue than purple, and my palms just about healed. "Well, that's good. Everything else okay?" I filled him in on the latest developments, including Marvin Stryker's hiring me to look into Audrey's death, my trip to San Luis Obispo, and my theory about her involvement in organized retail crime. Henry was properly sympathetic, mystified, and outraged, depending on what part of the story I was telling him, and he asked enough pertinent questions to fill in the blanks. "I'd offer to help, but there's not much I can do at this remove," he said. "Actually, there is. I need to borrow your station wagon for a day or two." "No problem. You know where I keep the keys." On we went in this fashion, and when we finally said our goodbyes, I realized we'd been on the phone for 45 minutes. As usual, I was starving to death, so I grabbed my shoulder bag and a jacket, locked my door, and trotted up the street to Rosie's. Claudia Rhines was sitting at a table near the door. She had a drink in front of her, grapefruit juice by the look of it, probably laced with vodka. I said, "Hey, how are you?" "Fine. I feel like I haven't talked to you in weeks." "It's been 5 days, but I know what you mean. You're meeting Drew?" "As soon as he takes his break. Are you up for a drink?" "I'd love one, but just until he arrives. I don't want to horn in on your dinner plans." "Is that vodka and grapefruit juice?" "It is. William brought in fresh squeezed juice just for me. You ought to try it." "Hang on," I said. We both turned to catch William's eye. Claudia held her drink up, indicating she needed a refill. I pointed to myself and held up two fingers. He nodded and leaned down to open the small refrigerator under the bar. I turned back to Claudia. "So, what's up?" "Too bad you weren't here sooner. You just missed a friend of yours."
"Sorry to hear that. Who?"
"Diana, somebody. She works for the local paper."
"You're kidding me. When was this?"
"I don't know, maybe 15 minutes ago. She came in shortly after I did and introduced herself. She said she didn't want to be a bother, but she had a few questions about my encounter with Audrey Vance."
"How did she know who you were?"
"I thought you told her."
"I never said a word."
"That's odd. She knew I worked at Nordstrom's, and she knew I was there when Audrey was arrested. She said she was fact-checking a few items her editor wanted confirmed. I just assumed she'd spoken to you first and was filling in the holes."
"No way.
She showed up at my office on Wednesday wanting to be all buddy-buddy. I don't talk to her about anything because I know how she operates. She'll extract all kinds of information while swearing up and down your comments are off the record."
"She said that just now, literally word for word. I told her I couldn't discuss Nordstrom's business.
Mr. Coslow takes a dim view of reporters. He's also paranoid about getting involved in the middle of a lawsuit. Not that there is one."
"So, what did you tell her?"
"Nothing. I referred her to him. That seemed to annoy her, but I couldn't see putting my job at risk, even if she's a friend of yours."
"She's not a friend, I swear. I can't stand the woman. She's a pushy, calculating bitch."
I gave her a summary of her relationship to Michael Sutton and how that disaster had played out.
"What's her interest in Audrey?" Claudia asked.
"She heard about Audrey's suicide, and now she wants to write an article about all the people who've taken headers off the Cold Spring Bridge. She went to Audrey's visitation and saw my name in the guest register. Then she wheedled her way into Marvin's good graces and he made the mistake of sending her to me. I had a fit when I realized what was going on. He's since repented, I'm happy to report. Oh, Lord. She sounds like trouble. I have no idea. I looked up to see William approaching the table with my vodka and grapefruit juice in one hand and hers in the other. I said, "Thanks. This looks great." "I hope you enjoy it," he said, and then returned to the bar. Claudia and I resumed our conversation, though there wasn't much more to say on the subject. She was relieved to hear she hadn't caused offense by refusing to discuss Audrey Vance with my good friend, Diana Alvarez, and I was relieved she kept her mouth shut for reasons of her own. In the interest of work, I skipped my run the next morning. I ate a bowl of Cheerios, then showered and donned my uniform a la Santa Teresa services. Shoulder bag in tow, I put my sandwich board sign in Henry's station wagon and backed out of the garage. The school day at Climping Academy started at 8 o'clock. By 7:30, I was parked on the berm at the bottom of the drive with my sign, which read, "This vehicle count is part of an environmental impact study and represents your tax dollars at work. We thank you for your cooperation and apologize for any inconvenience. Drive safely." I stood on the side of the road in my uniform, tally counter in hand, clicking off cars as they passed. On the plus side of the ledger, my shin felt better, still bruised, I knew, but not throbbing. On the minus side was a visitor. 5 minutes after I set up shop, a Horton Ravine patrol car rolled by and pulled over to the side of the road. The driver got out and ambled in my direction. He was wearing dark trousers and a white short-sleeved shirt. I didn't think he was a real policeman. He might have been a cop wannabe, but he wasn't driving a black and white. He had no badge, and he wasn't wearing a regulation uniform for either the STPD or the Sheriff's Department. In addition, he wasn't carrying a handgun, a nightstick, or a heavy-duty flashlight, which might serve as a weapon if I needed to be subdued. I was engrossed in my car count, so I couldn't give him my undivided attention. Blonde, mid-30s, trim with a pleasant demeanor, he took out a pen and pad and prepared to take notes or write a ticket. I wasn't sure which. "Good morning. How are you?" he asked. "I'm fine, thanks. How about yourself?" "Good. May I ask what this is about?" "Sure. I'm doing a vehicle count for the county." There was a brief delay while he processed my reply. "Are you aware this is a private road?" "Absolutely. No doubt about it, but as long as there's public access, it goes into my report." Mentally, he was going through his checklist. "You have a permit?" "For this?" I was told I didn't need one to do a road use analysis. "May I see some identification?" "I have my driver's license in my shoulder bag. I'll be happy to show it to you if you can wait until there's a break in traffic." He watched as two cars came through the main entrance. One turned up the drive to the school, and the other continued on into Horton Ravine. Click, click. I counted both. At the first gap in passing cars, I reached through the open window and picked up my bag from the passenger seat. He waited patiently while I paused to count a car. I took out my wallet, flipped it open, and offered it to him. He took it and jotted down my name, driver's license number, and home address in his notebook. I said, "That's Milhone with two L's. A lot of people leave out the second L." His name, I noticed, was B. Allen. "The car belongs to my landlord. He said I could use his today because mine's in the shop. The registration's in the glove compartment if you want to have a look. You'll see that my address and his are one house number apart." "That's not necessary," he said. He handed me my license and turned to watch cars approaching. One car passed, and I dutifully clicked. He'd already fallen into the rhythm of these intermittent interruptions. He looked back at me. "I don't see an EPA badge." "Don't have one yet. This is the first time I've been asked to do this. The Department of Transportation conducts an annual survey, and I was tapped for it this time. Lucky me." "How long do you anticipate being here?" "A day and a half, max.
I tally an hour in the morning and another in the afternoon, unless I'm sent somewhere else. You never know with these clowns. I held up a finger, saying, "Hang on," while I clicked off another car, turning up the drive to Climping. Sorry about that. We forward statistics to Sacramento, and that's the end of it as far as I know. Typical governmental boondoggle, but the pay's good. He pondered the proposition. It must have been clear I wasn't breaking the law. Finally, he said, "Well, just so you don't interfere with traffic, I'll be out of your hair as soon as possible. I'll let you go on about your business. Have a nice day."
"You too. I appreciate your courtesy."
"Sure thing." I was so busy maintaining the fiction that I nearly missed the Mercedes. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a black sedan speeding up the hill toward Climping, a young girl at the wheel. I couldn't read the bumper sticker, but it was pasted in the right spot and worth a closer look. Chapter 16. I waited until the Horton Ravine patrol car had pulled away. It was 8:05, and the cavalcade of arriving students had slowed to a trickle. I stayed at my post until 8:15 and then picked up my sign and tossed it into the back seat of the station wagon. Then I drove up the hill to Climping Academy and sailed into the parking lot. I cruised the rows of BMWs, Mercedes, and Volvos, and finally spotted the black sedan. The lot was full, and I was forced to park in a slot intended for the vice principal. I left my engine running while I doubled back on foot. The girl had locked the car, which forestalled my rooting through the glove compartment for the registration and proof of insurance. I wrote down the license number, which was actually a vanity plate that read "Hot Chick." The frame on the plate was a match for the one Maria had pointed out as she wound and rewound the CCTV tape. Now that I'd found the car, I had two choices. If I drove to the nearest pay phone, I could call Cheney Phillips and ask him to run the plate through his work computer. This would net me the name and the address of the registered owner in a relatively short period of time. Strictly speaking, however, it's against department policy, perhaps even illegal, to tap into the system for personal reasons. I was also acutely aware of Lynn Priddy's presence in all of this. If I called Cheney, he'd want to know why I needed the information. The minute I told him I was on the track of Audrey's shoplifting partner, he'd expect to be brought up to speed. Whatever I told him, even if I were vague and evasive, would go straight to Lynn Priddy, who was working the shoplifting angle for the Santa Teresa Police Department. Well, I know it's very naughty to withhold information from law enforcement, I thought it wise to leave Cheney out of the equation and thus reduce the chances of Len Priddy getting wind of my pursuit. My other option was to wait until school was out and tail the girl when she left. I wasn't crazy about the idea of lurking on campus until classes were dismissed. I certainly couldn't leave my car where it was. The vice principal was bound to show up, and how could I explain my poaching her spot? I decided to take off and return closer to the time when classes ended for the day. If the girl ducked out early, I'd be screwed. I could always come back in the morning and count cars again, but I wasn't sure how far I could push my EPA charade. Faux Officer B. Allen might consult the Horton Ravine rule book, bone up on the regulations, and chase me off if he saw me again. I surveyed my immediate surroundings. Tall hedges separated the parking lot from the administration building, with its second and third floor classrooms. No faces in the windows, no sign of a campus security guard, no students arriving late. I hunkered by the rear passenger side of the Mercedes and let the air out of the tire. I then went around and deflated the tire on the driver's side. I figured when school was out and my honor roll student discovered the two flats, she'd call the automobile club or a parent to come pick her up. In either case, the delay would allow me a clear field. All the other students and faculty would be gone, and I could linger near the entrance to Horton Ravine until my quarry appeared. I returned to my car and went home.
I left Henry's station wagon in the drive and let myself into my studio. I changed out of my uniform, which I hung in a closet, and substituted jeans. On my way out the door, I picked up the morning paper and shoved it in the outside pocket of my shoulder bag. Once at the office, I let myself in and gathered up the mail from the day before. I put on a pot of coffee. I had bolted down a quick bowl of cereal that morning before I left for Horton Ravine, but I hadn't had my coffee or a chance to catch up on the news. While the coffee brewed, I took my leftover Fritos from the bottom drawer of my desk and put them in my bag. When I returned to my vigil in Horton Ravine, waiting for the girl to leave school, I'd have them with me to munch on. Satisfied with my preparations, I settled at my desk and opened the paper. The first article that caught my eye, front page, left-hand column, had been filed under Diana Alvarez's byline. Police launch inquiry into suicide victims linked to organized crime. In the space of one sentence, I could see she'd abandoned the usual reporter imperatives, who, what, when, where, and how, and jacked up the tone for maximum emotional appeal. The April 24th suicide of Audrey Vance, 63, was first thought to be the unfortunate consequence of her arrest on shoplifting charges 2 days before. Her fiancé, Marvin Stryker, was shocked when the police arrived at his door to inform him that her body had been recovered from treacherous terrain off Highway 154. Santa Teresa County Sheriff's canine unit and a search and rescue team were summoned to the scene when a passing motorist, Ethan Anderson of Lompoc, noticed the victim's car parked near the bridge. When he stopped to investigate, he found the vehicle unlocked with the keys in the ignition. A woman's handbag and high heels had been neatly placed on the front seat. "I knew right then we had a problem on our hands," Anderson said. Queried about a suicide note, authorities indicated later there was none. Stryker, while vehemently refuting the notion that his bride-to-be would intentionally harm herself, admitted she'd reacted with extreme emotional distress to recent events. Vance, who died Sunday after a fall from the Cold Spring Bridge, had been apprehended April 22nd at Nordstrom Department Store after a local private investigator, Kinsey Milhone, witnessed the theft of several $100 worth of lingerie and reported the incident to sales clerk Claudia Rines. According to reports, Rines, who declined to be interviewed for this article, notified Nordstrom's loss prevention officer, Charles Coslow, who detained the alleged shoplifter in the mall after electronically tagged goods concealed in a shopping bag tripped an alarm. Vance was subsequently taken into custody and charged with grand theft. Letitia Jackson, public relations officer for the Santa Teresa Police Department, confirmed a report that a physical search of Vance by custodial officers revealed the presence of specially designed undergarments known as booster gear, in which additional stolen merchandise had been hidden. Pressed for a response, Costello said he wasn't at liberty to comment because he hadn't read the police report and wasn't a party to all the facts in the case. "We extend heartfelt condolences to her loved ones," Costello was quoted as saying. Marvin Stryker, 65, who was newly engaged to Ms. Vance, has asserted repeatedly that his fiancée would never have taken her own life. Audrey was the last person in the world who'd consider such a step. Asked to speculate whether her death was accidental or the result of foul play, Stryker said, "That's what I intend to find out." Stryker contacted Milhone of Milhone Investigations after a mutual acquaintance told him of her connection to the shoplifting incident. It was Milhone who suggested that Vance might be part of an organized retail crime ring operating in Santa Teresa and surrounding counties. When questioned, Santa Teresa Vice Detective Leonard Priddy said his department was looking into the allegation. "As far as I know, there's no truth to the rumor, which from our perspective appears to be purely fanciful." Priddy said a full-scale investigation was underway, but that he was confident no evidence of gang activity would surface. Milhone did not return repeated phone calls requesting comment. Vance is the 18th Santa Teresa County resident to plunge to her death. Caltrans representative, Wilson Carter, called the loss of lives resulting from individuals jumping from the 400-foot-high bridge a, quote, regrettable and entirely preventable tragedy, unquote. Statistical studies show that barriers erected on comparable structures contribute significantly to the reduction in suicide attempts. Carter further stated, quote, the long-term emotional and financial toll as a direct result of suicide offers a compelling argument for the construction of such a barrier, which has long been under discussion by state and county officials, unquote. A bereaved striker expressed the hope that his loss, however painful, might spur renewed interest in the project. In the meantime, the probe into the circumstances surrounding Vance's death suggests few, if any, answers to the sad and troubling questions generated by her fall from a bridge where so many have ended their lives in despair and isolation. My entire body was engulfed in heat. Diana Alvarez had slanted the truth, insinuating actions and attitudes I had no way to refute. It didn't surprise me she'd talked to a Santa Teresa Police Department vice detective. The fact that it was Len Pretty was just my bad luck, unless she'd somehow picked up on his disdain for me. His use of the terms allegation and purely fanciful in the same sentence suggested I was deluded. It was obvious he considered me a buffoon. She'd also implied that Claudia and I were deliberately ducking her inquiries into a sensitive matter of importance to the community at large. The woman was dangerous. I hadn't understood before the power of her position. She could present the so-called facts in any light she wanted, using neutral-sounding language to drive her point home. How many times had I read similar accounts and taken the contents at face value? The gospel, according to Diana Alvarez, was anything she wanted the public to believe. She was sticking it up my nose because she knew I had no way to fight back. She hadn't defamed me, and nothing she'd said had been libelous. Taking issue with her would only make me appear defensive, which would further her views. I got up and walked back to the kitchenette. I poured myself a cup of coffee. I had to hold the mug with two hands to keep the surface steady. I carried the coffee back to my desk, wondering how soon my phone would start to ring. What I was graced with instead was a visit from Marvin Stryker, who had a copy of the paper tucked under one arm. He looked as dapper as ever. Even in the midst of fuming, I had to admire the conservative dress code to which he adhered. No jeans and flannel shirts for him. He wore dark slacks, a muted sport coat, a white dress shirt, and a gray wool tie. His shoes were polished, and he smelled of aftershave. In an earlier age, he would have been known as a dandy or a swell or a man about town. He noticed the paper lying on my desk, which saved him beating around the bush. I see you read the article, same as me. So, what did you think? You come off looking a lot better than I do, that's for sure, I said. I told you she was a troublemaker. I gestured him into a chair. He sat down, posture erect, his hands on his knees. I'm not sure I'd call her a troublemaker. Granted, she's got a different point of view, but that doesn't mean she's wrong. Like she says, she's looking at the bigger picture. I already got two calls this morning wanting me to sign a petition in support of the suicide prevention barrier. Oh, come on, Marvin. That's a smokescreen. She's using the issue to stick it up my nose. She doesn't like it that I won't jump when she says jump. He stirred uneasily. I can see you're taking this personally, which is a mistake in my opinion. I understand you don't like criticism. None of us want to be held up to public scrutiny, so I don't fault you for that. I waited. He made no response. I said, finish the sentence. You don't fault me for that, so what do you fault me for? Well, you know, that vice detective didn't exactly endorse your point of view about Audrey and this gang stuff. Because he's just like Diana Alvarez, thrilled at the chance to cast me in a bad light. Why would he do that? I waved the question aside. It's not worth getting into. It's ancient history. I won't claim he hates me. That would be an exaggeration. Let's just say he dislikes me. And the feeling's mutual. I gathered as much. I mean, I wasn't sure how well you knew the guy, but he didn't come across as a big fan of yours. He was a friend of my ex-husband's, who was also a cop. Believe me, there's no love lost between us. I think he's a creep. Marvin's right knee began a subtle jumping that he stilled with one hand. Yes, well, that's an item I thought we should cover while we're at it. You don't like Diana Alvarez, and now it turns out you don't like the vice detective. No offense, but it sounds like they don't like you either.
Of course they don't. That's the point I just made.
Which presents me with a problem. The newspaper gal I don't care about so much is this vice cop. What's his name? Pretty. Right. If you'll remember our initial conversation, you said I should hire you because they considered you a professional. Now it looks like that's not true.
He doesn't consider me a professional at any rate, I said.
So that has me wondering.
About what?
If you're the best person for the job. I thought we could kick the subject back and forth between us. I'm curious what you have to say for yourself.
I've said my piece. You want to fire me? Fire me.
I never said anything about firing you, he said, aggrieved.
I thought I'd save you some time. No need to dance around the subject. You want me gone? I'm gone.
Don't be in such a rush. Thing is, I don't question your qualifications or your sincerity. It's just the police don't believe there's anything to this business about a shoplifting gang. You have to admit it sounds far-fetched, which I've said all along.
I'm not going to argue. You know why? Because it would sound self-serving, like I'm promoting my theory to protect my job. You're the boss. You can believe anything you want. Audrey was an angel, falsely arrested and falsely charged. She didn't throw herself off the bridge. She tripped and fell.
Now you're twisting my words. I accept Audrey stole things. I already gave you that the last time we talked. It's this notion there was more going on, like this big conspiracy. The cop isn't buying it, and he should know, don't you think?
Marvin, she had hundreds of dollars worth of stolen items in her underwear, which was specifically designed for just that purpose. Shoplifting wasn't a hobby. She was a pro.
That doesn't mean she was part of an organized ring. The cop pretty much said the whole idea was bogus.
Len Pretty would scoff at anything I said. You have no idea how contemptuous he is of me.
That's what I'm saying. You go forward, he's not going to cooperate, which means you and the cops are working at cross purposes.
What do you want to do? Just give me the bottom line here and let's get on with it. He shrugged, apparently not wanting to be pinned down without agonizing first.
This was Marvin's version of playing fair. I thought we should toss around some possibilities, like maybe you could confine your questions to how she died and leave the other part to the police.
If you think her death was a homicide, the sheriff's department is in a better position to investigate than I am. They'll bend over backward finding out what went on. I'm coming at events from the other end, trying to figure out what she was involved in and whether that got her killed.
He shook his head. Doesn't feel right to me.
It doesn't feel right to me either.
There's got to be a compromise. We split the difference, as it were, so you get what you want, and I do too.
This is a business arrangement. Compromise doesn't come into it. I think it's cleaner and more honest if we part company. No harm, no foul. You go your way, and I go mine. We shake hands and walk away.
I have a lot of respect for you.
Uh-huh, right.
No, I mean it.
So, how about this?
Go ahead and work off the money I paid you, and then we'll talk. That way, I don't come off looking like I'm disloyal or a cheapskate.
You're not a cheapskate. Don't be ridiculous. Who said that?
Diana mentioned maybe I was reluctant to cut ties because you might not give my retainer back and I didn't want to be out the bucks.
Why don't we leave her out of it, okay? Because here's the issue as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think you should pay me when you're so clearly convinced I've got my head up my ass. If you think I'm on the wrong track, it's a waste of your money and my time to go on with this. It's a vote of no confidence. I have confidence in you, just not the tack you're taking. Problem is, you could turn out to be right, and then how would it look if I...